Good morning, my name is Ruth, I'm one of the pastors here, and today we're continuing with our series, Recentering. This is a timely series because this is a tough time for many of us. Of course, there's the global pandemic going on with all the health impacts and economic impacts, there's depression, anxiety, many people are hurting. We're also in the final stages of a very divisive election season, in case you hadn't noticed that was going on. And whatever your political affiliations, I think we can all agree, it's been pretty ugly. There have been some really horrible things said and done. Voter suppression has been blatant. Violent threats have been made. The future feels far from certain. And at the end of the service today, actually, instead of having breakout groups to chat, we're going to have a short time of prayer for our country as we head into the final days of these elections and for peace and healing. So if you're able, please do stay online after the service and join us in praying for our nation. But the problems we're currently facing and the environments in which we find ourselves can seem overwhelming at times. And at other times, it can just leave us feeling drained and heavy, exhausted. So the focus of this series is to listen to and respond to Jesus' call to come to me, all you who are tired and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest. And we're doing that by looking at various practices, very simple, down-to-earth things that we can do to take care of ourselves and to recenter ourselves away from the anxiety and the strife and to focus on God's love for us. And we're not doing that to stick our head in the sand, proverbially speaking, or to put our fingers in our ears and live in denial, but we're doing it because we need to be centered. We need to be at peace in order to be able to engage well with the world around us. So 2 weeks ago, we looked at reflecting inwards and extending compassion to ourselves. And last week, we looked at being grounded in our physical selves, in our bodies, our homes and neighborhoods, and in this world, which is actually, despite everything that's going on, full of beauty, if we can just slow down and open up our senses to the divine presence that permeates everything around us. And this week, we are going to look at creativity. Now, just saying that word, probably some of us are mentally checking out. We're thinking, oh, this one's not really for me. I'm not very creative. Anybody thinking that? I say it a lot. I don't feel myself to be a very creative person. But I think one of the reasons we tend to think of ourselves as not very creative, if those of us who do think that, is because maybe we're not a great artist or poet or musician or dancer, and we tend to restrict our view of creativity to these kinds of classical art forms. But of course, there are so many ways of expressing creativity. Some of us are creative in the way we cook, or the way we dress can reveal a lot of creativity. Some of us are great problem solvers. We think outside the box and get things to work in new ways. Some of us think up games to play with our kids. Some of us are great at playing pretend. Others are great at telling stories or building things, or, you know, the list is endless. It seems we can be just about anything creatively if we try. In fact, last year, creative was among the 10 most used words in professional profiles on the networking site LinkedIn. We want to describe our jobs as creative. Well, I guess not if you're an accountant, actually. Creative accounting sounds a little dubious. But the rest of us, I think, want to be creative in what we do. And it's not just work, but life itself is an act of creativity. The photographer Jan Phillips wrote this: "It is blasphemous for any of us to say, I am not creative. All we do is create. We have desires and we create experiences from our desires. We have experiences and we create stories about these experiences. We wake up every day to an empty canvas of 24 hours, and every night we go to bed having created our masterpiece for the day. We can do this consciously or unconsciously, but we all do it nevertheless." Creativity is for all of us. We are all creating every day, whether we recognize it or not. But intentionally engaging creatively can be much more than that. It's much more than that kind of passive, life is creation. It can be a way for us actually to connect with ourselves and with God. It can even be considered a spiritual practice. Let's watch and listen to this brief clip, which asks the question, why make creativity a spiritual practice? And I think the clip is pretty creative itself.
Most people think of creativity as a hobby, a pastime, or a way to spend your Saturday afternoon. Yet the dictionary tells us that to create means to cause, to come into existence, to make, to originate. Creativity is the act of bringing that which does not exist into existence. It is the art of bringing forward that which has previously never lived. It is the remarkable experience of bringing something out of nothing. To be creative means to become intimate with your divine power. Now, in order to bring something new into the world, you must be willing to go into the unknown. Just as the poet might listen inwardly and stay open for the next word, and just as the artist might pay attention to the images that arise from within, creativity asks that we have one foot in what is known, or existence, and one foot in what is not known, or non-existence. To be creative, you must be willing to bring together form and formlessness, being and non-being, fullness and emptiness, nothing and everything. Creativity, in fact, requires the union of human and divine.
I think that's interesting phrasing. Creativity requires a union of human and divine. Scripture too indicates that we are called to be creative, and that creativity is a reflection of a divine characteristic, or a participation even in that divine characteristic. We looked at Genesis 1 last week, but we're going to look at it again from a slightly different angle. We read in Genesis 1, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And it goes on, "God created humans in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, God created them." So the very first characteristic of God that's given in Scripture is that God is creative. And we are made in God's image, which suggests that we too are made to be creative. And we see this creativity celebrated throughout Scripture as people develop agricultural practices, they write poems, they build temples, design beautiful objects, cook meals, sing, sew clothes, and do all kinds of other creative things. We are made to be creative. As Madeleine L'Engle phrased it, creativity is a way of living life, no matter our vocation or how we earn our living. Unfortunately, though, right now, there's a very good chance you don't feel creative. Studies have shown that early in the pandemic, April, May time, there was a distinct rise in creativity as people, through necessity, came up with new ways of doing things, and as they used their time in new ways. However, many people report that the novelty of the situation has kind of worn off by now. Many of us actually don't want to bake bread week after week. We've perhaps taken a few classes online or thought up some new ways of celebrating a birthday without actually going anywhere, but it's kind of got old now and we might be in a bit of a slump. We're just kind of hanging in there rather than leaping out of bed in the morning eager for another opportunity to be creative and innovative. Although, if you are still leaping out of bed, embracing the creativity of the day, then that is awesome. Keep going. You're amazing. But if, like me, not so much, don't be discouraged, because you are not alone, not by any means. Many, many people are reporting a loss of creative energy for reasons that are well documented and have been for a long time, way before this pandemic. So first is stress. That's not a surprise. Stress can very often lead to a loss of creative energy and motivation. Second, distraction. Too many competing demands, as well as a loss of structure to our day. It's hard to be creative if we're juggling responsibilities and we don't have time set aside to be creative. Third, lack of exercise can leave us feeling lethargic and unmotivated. Some of the studies I was looking at emphasized exercise early in the morning, but I'm not a morning person, so I am not putting that on my slide. Fourth, we need to be well rested to be creative. Yeah, that one appeals to me a bit more. All of these factors, of course, can compound each other. Lack of exercise, stress, lack of structure, they can all cause problems with sleep, which in turn can add to stress and so on. So these are all quite basic and tangible factors, and I think the solutions are pretty obvious. Most articles seem to propose the same kinds of things. First, sleep. Make sure you're getting enough rest. Next week, actually, we're gonna just focus on rest, so we won't say anything about that one today. Second, be kind to yourself. Show self-compassion. And that, of course, was our first week in the series. Third, get outside, both for exercise and inspiration. We talked about that last week. Structure your day, have some kind of a routine, and build in time to be creative. It probably won't happen otherwise. Try something new. There are lots and lots of classes online. Many are free or they operate on a pay-as-you-can basis. YouTube videos, there's just endless numbers of those, teaching you how new skills and new ways of doing things, or giving creative prompts. There are books and so on. There are so many resources that can help us to try a new creative pursuit. I'm going to put a couple of links in the chat box, but if you found some fun resources, please do share them with us all. That would be great. Start small. If you've never tried building anything before, perhaps don't start with trying to remodel your whole house. Maybe you can build a shelf first and see how that goes. And keep going. As you keep trying new things and strengthening your skills over time, you'll have a much greater capacity for creativity. Okay, well, that's all pretty straightforward. God's made us to be creative, to express this divine attribute of bringing new things, beautiful things, helpful things, things that stretch our imagination into the world. But so what? Does it really matter? I mean, next to fighting injustice and serving people and loving our neighbor, does creativity really matter? It could be seen as a bit trivial, really. I mean, does anyone care really if we're creative or not? Well, actually, I think it does matter, which is a good job because otherwise this would be a short message. But I think it matters on a couple of levels. First, this whole series is about taking care of ourselves, and engaging with creative activities is a proven way of doing just that. Czech psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi popularized the concept of flow in the 1970s. Flow means a state where we experience focus and calm, and we lose track of time and place. I guess these days we'd probably call it being in the zone. But Csikszentmihalyi claims that our nervous system can only process 110 bits of information per second. Listening to the average person, he says, takes up about 60 bits per second. So that's why we struggle to really listen to two people speaking at once. And when we get totally absorbed in doing something that's creative, that we enjoy, that takes up the capacity of our nervous system. So we can't process the environment around us. We can't think about our worries or dwell on our regrets. We can't even track the passage of time. And so we lose ourselves, as it were, in that experience, in that moment. And psychologists tell us that this is actually a good thing to do. It gives us a mini vacation and decreases stress. It releases dopamine, a natural antidepressant, and may even protect against dementia. So creativity is good for us physically. God made us to share in the divine attribute of creativity. Many of you know Amanda, a longtime member of Cedar Ridge. Amanda is actually an art therapist. So creativity and how that can be good for us is something she knows a lot about. So I asked Amanda if she could share her particular perspective on all this. So let's listen to what she has to say.
Hi, my name is Amanda Bechtel. I am a member of Cedar Ridge and also an art therapist professionally. And Ruth asked me to speak to you guys a little bit about creativity through the lens of an art therapist. So for those of you who aren't familiar with art therapy, basically it's a way of working therapeutically that doesn't involve the language of words, or words are not the primary language. So in a traditional talk therapy, you might go in and the therapist may ask something, as you share an experience, they might say, how do you feel about that? And you answer how you feel about that. In art therapy, it might be more like, show me how you feel about that. And the client is going to use drawing or painting or collage or some visual representation of their experience. Now, to be clear, this does not mean that you have to be an artist to participate in art therapy. In fact, artists are some of my tougher clients because they have an agenda for how they want something to look stylistically. And really, this is about process instead of the product. This is my underlying assumption, is that all of us as human beings have the ability to be creative, that it's something we're born with. As being made in the image of God, the great creator, that's an aspect of who we are. unfortunately, it gets socialized out of us, and we become self-conscious. And, you know, the kid who delights in showing their parents the masterpiece, you know, scribble that they made in preschool, by the end of, you know, say elementary school or late elementary school, may have just, you know, most of us have decided whether we are or are not an artist at that point, or a good artist. So the first thing I have to do is kind of undo all of that and get people back to a place where they're willing to kind of play and experiment and express. And so the language in art therapy is, like I said, it's not so much words as images. And with images come color, shape, and line. So if I'm talking to somebody and I'm sharing, you know, an expression of sadness, oops, I guess I'd do this so you guys can see. It might be kind of a meandering path, and it might be blue, and I might spiral at the bottom. And that may be what sadness feels like to me. But if you asked me to express anger, that might be a little bit more pointed, and it might be a little bit hotter. And there might be some pressure, and for me, it might be a little red. If you asked me about feeling ashamed, I might do a little gray dot, because when I feel that feeling, I just want to disappear. And then my personal favorite would be anxiety. And I'm sorry, I'm not holding this very clearly, but for me, anxiety is like, let's put them all together over top of one another, and we're going to make one giant knot of emotional mess. And honestly, this is all the skill that is necessary to do art therapy, because what it's about is tapping into the internal experience and then expressing it authentically. You know, there's a reason for the cliche that a picture is worth a thousand words. An image can hold all kinds of tension and paradox, and it can be this and it can be that, and it can hold all kinds of conflicting emotions. But as soon as I start to talk about it, I get down this path and then down this path and down this path, and it's hard to hold all of that at the same time. So one of my favorite things about art is the way that it can hold the complexity of and the paradoxes of our experience without needing to make it either or. But what I find most satisfying in this process is when people come to me kind of identified with a diagnosis. So I work a lot with clients who struggle with eating disorders, and they come in and, you know, they are their anorexia, or, you know, somebody who is struggling with substances, they are the addict. They are, you know, somebody is, you know, they feel like they are their depression. And in working in learning to trust themselves and trust their instinct and trust their vision and trust their inner knowing, they are getting to know themselves, my clients are, and then also developing a new identity as a person who is creative. Some even go so far as to reclaim the identity of artist, even though they are not going to be, you know, displaying their work in any galleries. But it's a sense of identity that I think is really healing and powerful for all of us to kind of reclaim as we are able. So you can, you know, if you're interested in exploring at home, you can do a Google search for art therapy interventions. And I think the first thing that pops up is, you know, 200 prompts. I also encourage you to see a professional if that doesn't feel safe for you, because it can bring up a lot of emotion and, you know, stuff from the past. But if you're really just interested in playing with art materials or trying to reclaim some aspect of your creativity or your, you know, human right as a creative person, that could be a good place to start for some prompts. And I encourage you to ask your, you know, inner critic to sit to the side and let you play the way you would have played as a child, and to kind of reclaim some of that creative headspace. So I'm also happy to talk with anybody who has questions about art or the creative process or my journey as an art therapist. So thank you guys. Miss seeing you in person.
Thanks so much, Amanda. But if we were made for creativity, if it's part of our identity, as Amanda was saying, and if it's proven to be good for us, why do so many of us resist making time to be creative? Now, obviously, sometimes we're just distracted, we're busy, we don't have time. I think that's normal, it's part of life. But there are a couple of deeper issues, more spiritual issues, if you like, that I think are worth thinking about. First, many of us discount our creativity because we think we're not good enough. This is something Amanda already touched upon. We're not highly skilled artists or musicians or builders or cooks or whatever else. So we think that what we do, it doesn't really count for much. It's got no value. We might even be very critical of ourselves and find fault with what we do. Now, some critical assessment might actually be constructive to help us improve, but most of us, or at least some of us, have a tendency to put ourselves down. We hold ourselves to a really high standard and speak to ourselves much more harshly than we would speak to a friend. Coming back again to our foundational issue of self-compassion, we read in Isaiah, "You, Lord, are our Father. We are the clay, you are the potter. We are all the work of your hand." Scripture teaches that we are God's work of art, God's creation. Maybe we can remember that when we speak negatively to ourselves. If someone we loved showed us a piece of art they had created, would we criticize it and pull it to pieces? Or would we look for the beauty in it, the skill of it, the originality? Let's look at ourselves appreciatively and compassionately. Isaiah describes God not just as our creator, but also as our Father. And think for a moment of the joy of a child's picture, the joy that brings to parents, grandparents, aunt, uncle, whoever cares for a child. We don't critique that, we delight in it. Pablo Picasso said, "Every child is an artist. The problem is how to remain an artist once we grow up." Every child, or perhaps it's more accurate to say every healthy child, is an artist because they haven't yet learned to put themselves down. They have the confidence to just go for it and have fun with it. But as Amanda noted, we quickly lose that confidence. We learn to color inside the lines. We worry about whether our creations are as good as someone else's. We compare and critique and we feel the need to perform. And so we lose the joy of creating. It becomes something that's competitive and stressful. It becomes about the finished product rather than the fun of the process. We no longer lose ourselves in the flow. One practice I'd like to suggest this week is to engage in something creative and intentionally silence your inner critic, or at least try to ignore it. There are various ways to do that. Some people find it's helpful to journal a stream of consciousness before they start creating, just to get all the voices out of their heads. Or you might want to sit in an attitude of prayer and just let go of the thoughts that come into your mind. Maybe you can imagine them as leaves drifting down a stream, or as bubbles passing by and pop them with a pin. But make room for silence and stillness and for an awareness of God's presence with you before you jump into creating. That can help. You might want to imagine as you work that you're actually watching a friend create and provide encouragement to that friend throughout the process. Or you might want to create things that you intentionally don't keep and don't share with others, so as to maintain the focus on the joy of creating rather than on the end product. Something I had fun with the other day was what the artist Matisse called flying with scissors, where you cut shapes that try to capture the essence of an object, but you do it quickly and in one go so that you don't have time to start second guessing yourself. So for example, we have a reclining nude, and we have an acrobat, and we have some things that look like things in nature and so on. Again, no judgment. It's about the process. It's not about the project. And in fact, when you're done, you can just throw these away because it's not about the product. It is about the process. Creating something transient or holding our creations lightly can help us to overcome our inner critic. It focuses back on the process. But whatever works for you, you know, play around with those ideas, give it a go. I'd encourage you to ignore all the voices that say, "Oh, this is a waste of time," or "It's not very good." Just give something creative a go. Letting go of the end product brings me to a second reason I think some of us resist making time to be creative, and that is we prioritize being productive. We think we don't get to play anymore because we're adults and we've got lots of responsibilities. And I think some of us even assume that God created us as servants or laborers, that we are made to serve God, to work for God. Now, serving is important, obviously. I'm not at all saying we should just live selfishly, do whatever makes us happy and ignore everyone else. Clearly not. Serving is central to what it means to follow Jesus. But I think some of us have a view of God as someone who maybe is quite judgmental, very serious, has high expectations of us that maybe we can never quite live up to. But I would suggest that that's not who God is. Again, going back to the book of Genesis, we read last week this verse, "The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it." That sounds quite creative, tending a garden in harmony with God, acting as the image of God. But after humanity has rejected God's way and rebelled against God in chapter 3 of Genesis, we see God and work presented in a very different light. We read, this is God speaking, "Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return." This is a very different perspective now. From this perspective, God has cursed us. We don't get to live harmoniously and creatively. We view ourselves as people who have to painfully toil. But we still sense that this isn't how it's meant to be. This isn't how we were created to live. This isn't the relationship we're meant to have with God. Similarly, in the story of the prodigal son, I'm sure you remember that story, the younger brother takes his share of the inheritance even before his father's died. He wastes it all and he comes home begging to be allowed back as a servant. But the father welcomes him as a beloved son and throws a feast in his honor. Meanwhile, the elder brother refuses to join the feast. He sulks out in the field until the father comes to find him and pleads with him to join the celebration. We read in Luke, "But he," the elder brother, "answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, but you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fatted calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" It's clear from the story that the father never asked his son to slave for him. To work alongside him in creative partnership, sure, but not to become a slave, a mere laborer. The father totally rejects that idea for both his sons. God doesn't ask that of us. We are God's children, not God's servants. Like the father in the story, God calls us to join the celebration, a celebration of life and love, forgiveness and second chances. We are called to live exuberantly and joyfully. So our second practice is to intentionally set aside time to create just for fun, just to celebrate the gift of life. And then finally, as I mentioned earlier, we resist making time to be creative because we have too narrow a view of what we consider creative. We think of all the things that maybe we're not so good at rather than thinking of ways that we can be creative in our everyday work and life. So our third practice is to be creative about being creative, to look for ways this week in your everyday life to add some creativity, like when you go to vote. And our friend Margie did just that. So let's hear from her.
So I went to vote last weekend, and I wore this Edwardian costume that I made earlier this year in recognition of 2020 being 100 years since women obtained the right to vote in the United States. And when I was doing the research on the type of clothing that women wore in the early 1900s, I found out that the Chinese, who've been in the United States since the mid-1800s to late 1800s, were not given that right. And that was because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, which lasted more than 60 years in the United States. And the act banned immigration specifically for the Chinese, and it banned citizenship. So because if you weren't a citizen, you weren't allowed to vote. So I could have worn this costume over the summer, but I decided to wear it later in the year, especially when I went to vote, because we didn't get that right until 23 years later than everyone else. I wore it also because it was in honor of everyone who fought for my right, even before I was born. And I don't want to ever take the right to vote for granted. But very quickly, so I made the skirt. It's a combination of linen and cotton, and it came from a sewing pattern. The shirt was purchased, and the hat I already had. It was a plain hat with a black ribbon on it, so I ripped that off and used a hot glue gun, and I glued on some silk peonies, and the tulle that's on there is actually a tulle that I saved from my wedding veil that I made 9 years ago, because a crafter never throws away anything. So there you have it. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Margie. Such wonderful creativity. We have a couple of other members of our community too, who are going to briefly share about how they have been creative in the last couple of months. So Derek, over to you.
Hi, Cedar Ridge. My name is Derek, for those who don't know me. I am going to show you a board game that me and Ellen, my fiance, invented over quarantine. We call it Game of Lines. It was Ellen's idea to make it. One morning she was just like, hey, Derek, let's invent a game. And I honestly was not so sure about it. I was kind of thinking that it would be really hard and that I didn't have any ideas. But I agreed to, mostly because I didn't want to be lame and not fun. So we started brainstorming, and pretty quickly I got excited about it because we just broke out some paper and colored pencils and started writing down all of our ideas, or just like things about games that we like. So for example, our first idea, or Ellen's idea, was see who can draw the straightest line, which I thought was hilarious, and that's how we actually named our game, even though it has very little to do with the game that we made. And we had a lot of other ideas, and eventually we pieced this all together to create the Game of Lines, which is actually pretty complicated, so I won't explain all of it. Like, the rule book is 7 pages long plus an 8th page jumbo version, which is 8 to 12 players, so I guess we can try that out post-COVID. But the idea of the game is basically to find the resources on the board that you need to build a boat to get to the Island of Fortune. And you play as a specific character in the game who has like a unique ability. And then you can also, you start out usually like in an alliance, but you can leave your alliance or join someone else's alliance throughout the game at different times, really at any time. It's kind of like an anything can happen game with a lot of different factors. We also have this thing called, we have mini games like Mario Party, which are like 40 little games that we came up with. Oh, I broke them. That, like, things like sardines that take like 10 minutes, or Nerf Marco Polo, or stupid little stuff like that. And when you win those games, you get coins, and you need the coins to get the resources to win the game. So that's a little bit about our game. We've had a lot of fun playing it with our roommates and a few of our friends. It's actually been like really fulfilling for me and Ellen to like invent a game that we can play with people and have fun with. And our friends have been really nice, and they've helped us with the game and even just been nice enough to play a weird game that we invented. So that's been cool. And if anyone wants to play, let me know. We would love to play with you. And thanks for listening.
Thanks, Derek. The Mansons, meanwhile, took a game that already existed and adapted it to allow for social distancing. Heidi and Greg will tell us about that.
We first saw the game Nine Square played at a high school party a few years ago. A large number of students had fun continuously playing the game for hours, with students joining and leaving the game whenever they chose. I observed that everyone appeared to have fun, no matter what their skill level was, and people who might not have felt comfortable joining a regular volleyball game with teams were stepping up and trying a turn or two in this low-pressure game. Last year, we built a frame for our family to play at YMCA Camp Letts. We were pleased to see many families with people of all different ages enjoy playing the game throughout the weekend.
Nine Square is similar to volleyball, except it's played as individuals instead of teams. Nine people stand under a frame. Each person defends their square from the ball. The play starts with a person in the center square. When the ball is tossed within a person's square, they must hit it out and land within another person's square. Whenever a person is unable to hit the ball out of their square, or if they hit it out of bounds, they must leave the frame and wait for another turn in line. The square they leave is empty and is filled from the people rotating within the grid. A new person joins the game at the starting square. Your goal is to make your way to the center square where you start the next play.
When the CDC first issued guidelines on social distancing this past spring, I thought of this game. Our frame is a grid of 4-foot wide squares. And what if we built the frame to be a 6-foot square to allow people to stand further apart? The larger frame would allow friends and family to be active and have fun and follow social distancing guidelines.
I knew our frame was 4-foot squares was not very stable, and making it 50% larger would definitely not work. We need a much stiffer frame, so instead of the 1-inch pipes we had, we increased them to 1.25 inches. We also added horizontal members for bracing. The new bracing not only makes the frame more stable, but also helps player understand the pathway through the grid and reminds people to stay within their grid.
We have temporarily constructed our new frame between the farmhouse and the barn. We invite all families to bring a ball and have fun playing the game at any time. The grid has 9 squares, but the game can be played with less people. If you have more players, the extra people just need to stand in a line and space themselves 6 feet apart. Please limit the total number of people in your group to be within the current Montgomery County guidelines. Please also remember to wear a mask at all times when gathering with people outside your household. Have fun, everyone.
Thanks so much, guys. That's great. So I hope you will see this as an invitation to be creative in whatever way you can. This is not yet something else on the to-do list. It's not a moral imperative. It's a gift. We are invited by God to play, to create, to imagine, rethink, let go of rules and boxes and the proper way of doing things, and have fun celebrating life. So I'd really invite all of us this week to find some way to lose ourselves in creative joy. There are detailed suggestions for how we might do this in the discussion questions for this week, including things like going for a walk with your camera, playing with paint, eating something new, no bats, please, no bats. Telling stories, painting color, finding a new use for something that's broken, and so on. And as always, you can find these materials on our website. We're going to take communion now. Communion is symbolic of so many different things. One thing we can focus on today is that feast that the Father holds in celebration of his son coming home in the story of the prodigal son. God's own rejoicing and celebration of us returning to God. So let's eat and drink with joy this morning as the Fullers lead us in communion.